The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. Coming to you from Campbell Hall. Today, we're going to be talking about Herbert Schiller, one of the really giant figures in media studies and critical media analysis in American history in the United States, a dominant figure, in fact, in the second half of the 20th century, and a seminal figure. And to talk about him, we're going to bring in the author of a new biography or profile of Schiller that's just been published by Roman and Littlefold. Dutifully and accurately titled Herbert Schiller. And joining us is this author, Richard Maxwell. Rick Maxwell, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's an honor to be on the air with you.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and I should let our listeners know that Rick Maxwell, who's a professor and the chair of the Media Studies Department at Queens College of the City University of New York, is a friend of mine. I was on his PhD committee when I was on the faculty at Madison. This goes back many, many, many years. If Rick is a full professor and a chair now, you can get some sense of that. He has written other books, including the widely and highly acclaimed Spectacle of Democracy, Spanish Television, Nationalism, and Political Transition. And he's also the editor of Culture Works, The Political Economy of Culture, and the co-author of Global Hollywood, another work of critical media analysis that's drawn a great deal of acclaim internationally for its media assessment. So, Rick, Herb Schiller. Why did you write a book about Herb Schiller?
Well, Herb was great inspiration in my own life and career in the critical study of media. Herb is someone who, when he passed away in 2000, I was deeply affected by that, and was meeting in New York with friends, and we were talking about what impact he had on our life and our thinking. And at that point, we put together a special issue of a journal called Television and New Media, which was devoted to the remembrance of Herb Schiller, and we quickly found people who could contribute their own thoughts, including your very, very nice essay on Herb. And at that point, I began to kind of toy with the idea of doing something just a little bit more more informative, more substantial about the work that marked his career, that made him what he became, the leading, what Ed Herman called the leading left scholar of communication studies in America. Well, I was asked but then by Andrew Calabresi, the editor of a series at Roman and Littlefield, if I would follow up the special issue I did with a more substantial work on Herb Schiller.
Yeah, before we go into any more detail, we should probably give our listeners here to Media Matters a sense of what the scope of Herb Schiller's work was, why you were attracted to him. What were some of the key issues that Herbert Schiller wrote about, studied, examined, taught about during his long career as a writer?
That's a very good question. It's a long answer.
Yeah, why don't you just give, instead of going into any detail, let's give the summary, just a few words on each, and we'll talk about them in more detail later. But just so our listeners right now have a sense of why we're doing the show.
Yeah, I think the most important thing about Herb Schiller's work is that it wasn't abstract communication theory. He was writing about the political condition and what he called the informational condition of Americans. He was concerned with the enclosures around the informational resources that Americans have, really was concerned with the military and what was called back in the 60s the military-industrial complex, and the role that those forces had in shaping and controlling the informational resources that were available to Americans, specifically in relation to Americans' understanding of foreign policy during the Cold War. These were some of the real initial motivations or provocations that got him into the communications area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he began as an economist, and his area of specialty was resource allocation, and this was more or less how he dealt with communications as a valuable resource. And so he saw the accumulation and of these resources in the hands of military and corporate interests as a problem for American democracy.
Yeah, you mentioned he's written a series of books. The first great book he wrote was published, I believe, in 1969, when he was almost 50 years old.
That's right.
So it was really, he got into the game relatively late for a publishing scholar in the field, then wrote over the next three decades a series of highly influential books dealing with global communication, United States foreign policy, technology, culture. When he came into the field of media studies or communication, had there been a long tradition of the sort of work he did? I mean, was this an established discipline at American universities?
No, it was a new discipline, and the communication studies itself was developed as a professional discipline in the post-war period. There's a terrific book by Chris Simpson on the relationship between the psychological warfare studies that were conducted and the sort of transformation of those studies into what became the professional communications studies business. Herb Schiller came to this rather late, and also from a completely different orientation to the material. There was no real strong critical communications force within academia, except for one individual named Dallas Mize, who was an instructor, professor at the University of Illinois, former researcher at the FCC, who had been teaching a course on political economy of communication since the late 40s. He was really a guiding figure in Herb's introduction to communication. And in fact, when Dallas Mize left Illinois, the course political economy of communication actually made its way to Herb, and that's when he began to really see the importance, the sort of pivotal role that communication played in the U.S. What was becoming clear to him was the U.S. Imperial aspirations around the world.
You know, Herb Schiller was deeply interested in the role of media and communication in social power, inequality between social groups, inequality between nations. When he came into communication and over the 50s and 60s, he gravitated from being an economist to being a media scholar by the end of the 1960s. What was the existing discipline? You talked a little bit about this, but what was the existing discipline of communication studies or media like in the United States? I mean, what was the terrain like that he was entering aside from Dallas Smythe?
Well, it was primarily a combination of behavioral sciences and political science. A lot of people were concerned with the effects that media had on people's behaviors, and this grew out of an interest in strong effects research from the propaganda side. You know, the effect that propaganda campaigns would have in a psychological warfare, and some of the key figures there, people like Daniel Lerner and Wilbur Schramm. This translated into more sort of innocuous-sounding studies like national development and communications and in the area of international communications. People like Wilbur Schramm were probably the leading lights of the field, and their work was very much concerned with sort of transposing an American-style vision of modernization onto third-world societies in obvious competition with the other model at the time, which was the Soviet communist model. So this was what Herb saw when he first dealt with this as a kind of theory of empire, or the theorist of empire, as he later called it in his later work.
We're talking to Rick Maxwell, the author of a brand new book called Herbert Schiller, Today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. We did it shortly before going on air so we could have an opportunity to get Rick Maxwell in the studio. So don't call in today. Just sit back, relax, enjoy the show. Herb Schiller, one of the giant figures of media studies, one of my mentors in many ways, and someone who's inspired many of the guests who've been on this program over the past 2 years. Someone I think you're all going to be interested in the more you learn about him. And Maxwell's new book, which we're talking about today, does a commendable job of communicating the lead key themes throughout Schiller's career on media as part of empire, on hyper-commercialism, the role of technology, and the general field of media studies, which he so strongly shaped and influenced throughout his life. Herb Schiller, let's talk a little bit about Herb Schiller, his background, where he is from, what drew him into academic life. What do we know about Herb Schiller?
Well, you know, Herb grew up in New York City at a time of great social ferment. There was a lot going on around in the period of when he was a teenager with you know, in sort of investments during the Franklin, the Roosevelt administration, investments in sort of socially progressive cultural works, and there was a lot of ferment in theater and novels, and I think, you know, he, well, like a lot of New Yorkers, grew up with a great sense of humor, a great wit, ability to turn a tall tale into a political tract almost. He was quite, as far as I can tell from all my research, you know, quite the storyteller, and I think a lot of that has to do with the context. It's not just you know, the New York setting, but also the time. This was a very interesting time for people who, in New York, and they were influenced largely by a lot of left-wing and socialist-inspired works, and I think that had a lot to do with his own background.
Yeah, what sort of background did Herb Schiller come from? Was he from a wealthy family, suburban? Where was he from? What was it
right.
like for him growing up?
Right. Well, his father was a jeweler who lost his job when the Great Depression took place. His mother cleaned buildings. She cleaned buildings for the school system. He really grew up in a working class environment, but there was a lot of distress, especially in the family setting at the time when he was, you know, just a preteen, I guess you'd say. But the family worked very hard to make sure that he had an education, which, as he said, they could barely afford. They struggled, and he finally made it to the City University of New York, well, City College at the time, when tuition was free, and it was one of the best educations you could get. He managed to graduate just shy of his 21st birthday, I believe.
And he went into the service. He was born in 1920, is that right?
1919. Yeah.
And so then World War II puts him directly in military age in the early 1940s.
That's correct. Well, it wasn't just that, but also that there were no jobs. And Washington had called, and it was first before the military, worked for the, I think it was the Labor Department, and he did some economic research there. But once he was inducted into the military, he served in North Africa for most of the time he was there. In the post-war period, after the war ended, he continued to work for the military in the military government in Germany, in the sort of reconstruction of Germany and what was called the democratization. And so that was, a very strong influence in his life.
Yeah, how did that influence him?
Well, in both his memoirs and in his writing, you can see that he learned very quickly that there was, within the upper echelons of the ruling circles within the military government, ideas about how the country should be reconstructed and what the new political economy ought to be. Now, he was inspired to go to Germany because he assumed that this would be a place where there could be lots of opportunities for progressive change, since the Nazis had been defeated, and there was, at least in theory, the opportunity to create new social institutions with greater progressive aims in mind. But what he learned pretty quickly was that the U.S. leadership had something else in mind for Germany, basically the sort of reestablishing on the ground a market economy, much like the U.S.'s market economy. So he learned this because he had a job which put him in, by accident, in the upper circles. He wasn't executive of any sort, but he was working near the leading circles, and he really was informed by, as I say, listening into these higher circles of ruling groups. In some ways, that opened up his eyes to the imperial aspirations of the American government.
We're talking to Rick Maxwell today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Rick Maxwell is the author of the new book, Herbert Schiller, one of the key thinkers in critical media studies, published by Roman and Littlefield. And we're talking about that book. We're talking about Herb Schiller today in Media Matters. We've pre-recorded this show so we could get Mr. Maxwell into a studio. Please don't try to call in. Just sit back and relax. Herbert Schiller, one of the giants of critical communication work with a long and illustrious career. And much of that career, or at least a key part of that career, we should say, if not much of it, was spent right here in Urbana, Illinois, at the University of Illinois. And that seemed to be the decisive turning point in Schiller's sort of emergence as a communication scholar. Is that fair to say, Rick Maxwell?
Yes, the Illinois experience was definitely the change. He had been teaching economics up to that point. He had gotten a job at the Bureau for Economic Research, I think it's called. And prior to that, he was teaching in New York at Pratt Institute and part-time at other schools, but in the area of economics. It was really this relationship he had developed with Dallas Mize, who he had known through other friends of this work in this area of communications, which, you know, he wasn't quite sure what it was about. You know, kind of a new field. You know, it's not as established as the area of economics, but he began to become more interested in it as I said earlier, after beginning to teach a course on the political economy of communication. What it allowed him to do was to translate a lot of his interest in resource distribution to the questions of informational distribution, and this abiding concern with the haves and have-nots of the world, if you will, was transposed onto this interest in the informational haves and have-nots, and how the control over informational resources really set or stratified these groups.
Schiller's first great book came out in 1969, just as he was leaving the University of Illinois to go to the University of California at San Diego, Mass Communication and American Empire. And it really, I think, was the work that instantly put him on the map as sort of a crucial figure in media analysis. What was that book about? What was the argument there? What was unique and special about that book?
Well, there were two main things from my point of view. The first was to link the growing control over informational resources that he saw the military-industrial complex taking in the United States, but also to look at the new technologies of satellite and how the Kennedy administration had established certain hegemony over the development of these new technologies within the context of their own foreign policy aims. And what he was able to do was to look at this not as some sort of benign or neutral technology that's going to lead to some modernization of the world or the improvement of the human condition or the creation of a global village.
Which was, in fact, at that time the dominant position in academia.
Exactly.
And across society, but especially among scholars of communication, that was the standard position.
Exactly. Well, it was a mix of those positions, but the idea that technology was neutral really just dominated the field, yes. But he didn't write it as a polemic against that. He was really coming at it from completely autonomous work that he was doing. It just happened to be, or happened to offer to a lot of younger researchers at the time, an eye-opening read on the question of technology, on the question of the provenance of new technologies, on the question of who controls and who distributes and who gets to decide what kind of technologies are created. So it had great impact for that reason after it got read. The problem was that it was published originally by a very small one-man operation and was only taken up after a couple of good book reviews, but for the most part it had been ignored. And then it was published by a trade press. Beacon published it after that.
And it did really well, didn't it? Because that's certainly how I first became familiar with Schiller.
Yes, that book and then a follow-up book, Communication and Cultural Domination, really, I think, established his name.
And Communication and Cultural Domination came out in the mid-70s, if I'm not mistaken, and
yeah.
Sort of developed those themes quite a bit more?
Right. Well, keep in mind that, you know, he'd been working on, you know, Mass Communication, American Empire throughout the 60s. You know, parts of it had been published prior to it coming out in book form. The same with the subsequent books, The Mind Managers in 1973, Communication and Cultural Domination in 1976, very common that you'd see sort of collection of previously published work. So these are things that you can kind of track, and I try to do this in the book, track the shift in interests or the shift in ways of getting the information out there. Because he would try to put together an analysis, and then a subsequent book might come out where it was much more focused on how to translate that into public policy. So he would, shift his concerns, but also he would take on different writing projects, in a sense.
Well, I think that's pretty common among scholars. I mean,
one would hope.
One would hope. Certainly, that's something to aspire to. I think you point out in the book. I think you argue that the Communication and Cultural Domination is arguably his most influential book.
I would say so. Yeah.
And why was that? What was this, that came out again in the mid-70s. What was so influential about it? What was its argument and what was its influence?
Well, let me go back to the Mass Communication American Empire. This book was probably, to put it mildly, ignored by the American communications establishment. He was treated as this Johnny come lately to the field. The leaders of the field really didn't look on it as any kind of important book. Where it did have an impact was with international scholars. First, with work that was being done through the auspices of the UNESCO research on information flows and communication, and the people from who were involved in that from Europe, Middle East, later Latin America and Asia, took up Schiller's writing and were taken aback by the accuracy of this American writing about the conditions around the world and the impact that U.S. empire had on communication and cultural conditions. So he began to build an audience, an international audience, which was, I think, much more congenial with his thoughts and with his positions. By the time Communication and Cultural Domination came out, the international audience had been established, and I think I'm making a guess here, but it spread like wildfire at that point. It wasn't as difficult to take off as the first book, and so in some ways it had a much greater impact because there was an audience cultivated for his work by that point, and it was international in scope.
At the same time, Rick Maxwell, author of the new book, Herbert Schiller. The mid-70s, even the 60s, but going into the mid-70s were a period of tremendous turmoil politically at the international level. Mm-hmm. And in particular, for the first time, communication issues were really sort of becoming a central issue being debated globally. And Schiller's work sort of got right into the middle of these debates.
Absolutely. And that was his goal. He had been exposed with his entry into the communications field to colleagues and research that was very much in agreement with his own, and began to sort of go off into these new areas of cultural policy analysis. And he was very concerned with this book that it addressed policy issues which had come up in a number of different cases. Starting with UNESCO, but many national governments had been looking at the idea of creating national communications policies.
Yeah, let's dress this up a little bit, Rick, because I think our listeners would be interested in this, and there's no way they would know much about it, especially if they used our news media to learn about it. During the Mass Communication American Empire argued that the United States was not a benign or neutral force in the world, but was in fact the dominant imperial power, and that communication was a crucial way in which it exercised its power, that communication was not neutral, but in fact supported U.S. economic and military interests around the world. Then along comes Communication and Cultural Domination, and during this period, what we see around the world is that an enormous number of countries have emerged that have become independent, that formerly have been colonies, and were suddenly very concerned with their own communication systems.
That's correct. And they were concerned with the abilities to change the way the international system worked. And discussions that sort of bubbled out of UNESCO came to be called the search for a new world information order, a new world communication and information order. So Herb became a part of this movement, I guess you could call it, and with his work tried to really tr- spectrum bring a critical view to the ideas of a national communications policy.
What was the goal of this movement, this New World Information Order, or that was primarily led by third world nations in the 70s? What was their ambition?
Well, it was primarily led by non-aligned nations, that meaning, of course, the nations which chose an independent path. Neither the U.S. nor the Soviet model would work. They wanted to come up with models for cultural and economic development that were that would serve their own political, social, and cultural histories, and not invite any kind of imposition of outside imperial forces. The concerns at first were all economic, and in the 60s it began to be more of an interest in the cultural matters. We see this in late 60s with the developments of third world cinema movements and also in the areas of communication infrastructure. Studies in the early 70s, empirical studies, for example, Carlin Ordenstrang and Tapio Veras' important study on the flows of information, began to show that there was a lot of imbalance in the flows. I mean, essentially, one-way flow from the U.S. to the rest of the world. And so, with this research in hand, many of the weaker nations, the weaker peoples of the world, we're able to point to this and say, look, we want to have a redress. We want to redress these imbalances. We want to change the way things work. We don't want the news agencies from the first world writing most of the stories about us, and in fact, writing most of the stories we read about ourselves. We don't want to read the first world vision of who we are as people.
Yeah, I mean, to put it in other terms, that if you're a newly independent country in Africa or Asia, but you don't control your media at all. They're still controlled by the former colonial power. How free can you be?
That's part of it. And also, if it's if you look at any of the examples that you just raised, you'd see that they were organized to serve the economic powers as well, not just the cultural powers. So, just the basic layout of a telephone system, for example, in North Africa, would make it easier to make a long distance phone call to a European capital than to call from one village to the next. So they were it wasn't just about cultural imposition. It was about a sort of inadequate infrastructure and how to overcome that kind of problem.
And what you see in this global fights over communication policy was Herb Schiller doing something that really distinguishes him. Why he became such a public figure is really taking his work outside the academy, outside of the lecture hall, and really trying to weigh in and attract people at the policy political level.
Well, that was where I think he got the biggest kick of all in his life. And it wasn't just about affecting policy, but really speaking to audiences who he imagined were already predisposed to be active citizens in some way. And this was true wherever he spoke to audiences. And I'm sure you probably recall hearing him stand up in front of a group of people and just really just, you know, in such incisive and clear language, boiling the arguments down to the key issues and really connecting with people. He was a great speaker. He was a great humorist. And you could tell he got a lot of pleasure out of addressing audiences in this way. So it wasn't just about affecting policy in a sense, but also affecting the thinking of the people who just come to his talks.
We're talking to Rick Maxwell, the author of the new book, Herbert Schiller, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. We wanted to get Rick Maxwell into the studio prior to the show so we could have this on the air. So no calls today to sit back. Please listen. Rick Maxwell's new biography, Herbert Schiller, is published by Roman and Littlefield. It just came out. Now, Rick Maxwell, I mean, you're interested, obviously, in the ideas that Herbert Schiller wrote about and he lived for and that he propagated, and we're going to talk about those throughout this program, but you also knew Herb Schiller, is that right?
Yeah, I met Herb Schiller when I was just a young undergraduate in the mid-70s at the University of California, San Diego, and, just a young guy in a lecture hall who was, inspired by this fiery speaker.
I mean, how inspired were you? I mean, did you have a lot of teachers who inspired you, or even among, I mean, did he just jump out from the rest of the pack?
Well, you should tell your listeners that, of course, you are in a lot of ways one of my teachers, Bob. So, you know, I can't let you get away with that, because, of course, you inspired me too, Bob. but Herb, Herb was someone who he paid attention. He cared about what the students were doing. And at that time when I was there, there was a lot of political activism on campus, mostly around the anti-militarization. We're looking toward the end of the Vietnam War here, but the movement was still alive. And so he was with us, and that was also inspiring. He acted in a very supportive role for us, as I say, very comradely. He was never he never dictated to us how we should go about dealing with things. He was just always there for us, and that I found to be very inspiring.
Yeah, a lot of professors are accused, especially those like Schiller, who popular writers, so who's writing takes a lot of their time, gets a lot of acclaim and attention, of not being very interested in being around students because they sort of get in the way, the prof scam sort of argument. What was Schiller like in that regard?
Well, it was the opposite with him. It was, for him, any invitation he had when he was first starting off in his career usually came from students. You know, they had read something he had written or they had heard about his speeches, and they were the ones who invited him to visit their campuses. The professors in the communication field were, uninspired by this man who was challenging U.S. foreign policy, and probably they were afraid of him in some ways. And I think in a lot of ways his popularity with students also irked them. They didn't like this man who was, considered to be a real treasure by the students coming in and sort of winning over students to whatever he was teaching.
Did that change over the course of his career? I mean, by the 80s or the 90s, as he'd written a few more books, which we'll be talking about, had he been embraced by the mainstream of his field and regarded as one of the great giants?
No, never embraced by the mainstream. In fact, I think a friend and colleague of his, Hamid Maulana, made this comment. He said the first time Herb Schiller ever appeared in the New York Times was when they published his obituary. He was never a public intellectual in the mainstream in that sense. He is in the United States. In contrast, his work made it to the mainstream critical press around the world. Well, anything outside the United States, I suppose, you could consider critical at this point. But he was a regular contributor to Le Monde Diplomatique, and others. So, one of the things anyone looking into the life of Herb Schiller will find is that he's sometimes just a footnote in communications history. He's sort of treated in some ways as marginal almost. And in fact, this is not the case when it comes to critical communications scholarship. And when you go across the border, when you go around the world and ask who are the great American communication scholars, Herb Schiller is in the top, and is in the top of the list.
Yeah, you refer in the book, Rick, to how his research was dismissed as not being scientific or especially rigorous. And I recall when I first began studying communication, dating myself a good 20-some years ago, that one of my professors just dismissed Schiller's work. Said, well, he's not a real scholar. He just sort of wings it. How did Herb Schiller, do you share that assessment? I obviously don't. How would you respond to that assessment? And how did Herb Schiller deal with that sort of criticism?
Well, I think Herb never saw his work as part of, as he says, an academic squabble. It was always something about, his work was, as I put it, he wanted his work to be in the flow of history. He wanted his work to be relevant. He wanted his work to be about matters that took us out of the ivory tower and put us on the ground to ask questions about the effects of whatever communication policy we were talking about or communication matter we were talking about. How does it affect people on the ground? I remember listening to him at a conference once. He was on a panel with very distinguished scholars in the field who were talking about the new broadband technologies and convergence, and there was a great technical explanation. There was a great follow-up with the difficulties of combination of policies across the European Union. It was, great historical analysis, great structural analysis. He got up and he said, "This is all well and good," but then he told the story about it was the time when trash barge off the coast of New Jersey had disgorged itself of hundreds of used hypodermic needles washed up on the shore of New Jersey. And he contrasted this. It was a stark image, especially at a conference, to contrast this image of the waste, of the inability to take care of basic problems with our blue sky conversation about the great new communications technologies. What are we talking about when we make new investments? What's all this money going to? He sort of pulled people out of the enchantment of talking about new communication technologies and the great things that can come about with internet or convergence or broadband, and made people stop to think, where do we want to put our resources? What are the priorities here? What are we talking about?
I'm glad you raised that issue, Rick Maxwell, because I think in the 1980s, as Herb Schiller was now in his 60s and entering his 70s, for my money, he really came upon some of his most important work. I mean, he was growing better with these years and a couple of major works. And the themes that really emerged, there were a couple. One you just talked about, which was a much more critical or skeptical view of technology and its sort of liberatory promise than was common and still is common to this day. And secondly, issues of hyper-commercialism, of commercialization of culture, of privatization of culture.
Right.
And what I think is maybe his most influential book, certainly within the United States, Culture, Inc., which was published in 1989. Talk a little bit about those two issues, if you would.
Well, in the late 1970s, he began to see this. Everybody who was in this field was looking at this question of the information society. You know, Daniel Bell had written about it, and others had written about it. And what was he concerned about when it came to this question of the information society? He looked at some of the literature on it, and he saw that there was again a lot of claims about the great changes that were going to take place. A lot of it had to do with the ruling circles in corporate world talking about how information technology and computers were going to help make it more efficient. And he began to look more closely at what was going on globally in terms of the changes in how global capitalism was organized and the important role that information technology played in coordinating management and labor in far-flung places and how it was about also the command over a new international division of labor that was taking place. And for him, that was a really key aspect of these new information infrastructures that were being put into place. But he also saw another trend at work, that while there was greater, let's say, expansion in terms of information technologies, there was also this increasing privatization over the informational resources. But he had been tracking that trend since the 1960s as well. It was just becoming much more apparent to him, and with his wife Anita Schiller influenced in some ways, because she was a research librarian and she was able to work with a lot of the changes that were taking place in librarianship and information uses there. He was able to see that a lot of the touting of the new databases that would be created, or the great access that people would have to information all over the world instantaneously through computers, was really also a way to try to make this much more of a proprietary resource, that is, that you would pay for that information at some point instead of having free access to it. In some ways, he was tracking that since the 60s, and he was looking at new trends, the way the government information providers were always sort of under attack. The Office of Management and Budget had long been trying to privatize a lot of the publishing activities of the government, making it harder for researchers to access this information, this publicly available information. So these were the trends: the privatization of information, the commercialization and turning it into a commodity in some ways, and tracking into also the use of information technologies as part of the command system over the international division of labor.
We're talking to Rick Maxwell today, Media Matters. He's the author of the new book, Herbert Schiller, published by Roman and Littlefield, which chronicles the life and contributions of one of the legendary figures of media studies, Herbert Schiller, who taught here at the University of Illinois in the 1960s before going on to the University of California at San Diego, who wrote numerous key texts in critical communication studies. And right now we're talking about some of his work in the 1980s when he was a leading critic of the Information Society and the notion that technology was neutral or would automatically free us. And then in 1989 he published another major work, maybe his last he had a couple more books after that, but I think the one that certainly drew the most attention that I can think of any book within the United States, called Culture, Inc., published by Oxford University Press, which is quite a shift from 20 years earlier being published by a religious publisher. What was Culture, Inc. about?
Culture, Inc., was really the culmination of a lot of these concerns. He brought it all together in culturing. He brought the study of the military industrial enclosures around information. He brought the question of privatization of information. He brought the question of the commercialization of cultural space, which was a concern of his. But he also brought this concern with Americans' informational condition to the core of this, I guess, argument of the book, to suggest that there was a sort of a creeping, not so creeping at the time, but, you know, in a sense, to raise our awareness of what was going on in the United States around our informational condition and why Americans were so ill-informed about world matters, why they were so ill-informed about foreign policy. And he began the book with the discussion of the McCarthyite period, talking about how the United States government and its agencies were able to shift the use of information through this campaign to create fear around the communist menace, and how these arguments about propaganda were so powerful at the time that they changed the number of ways that people accessed information, what information was made available, and who could actually provide that information to people. And he finally concluded a lot of his summary assessments of the field in a chapter on media power, where he discussed the role of communications research and cultural studies, and how, in fact, they all missed the boat when it came to understanding this impact that a propaganda environment around the Cold War, for example, around anti-communism, has such an incredible force that it can really shape public opinion.
Yeah, as I recall, the chapter you refer to, In Culture, it was one of the strongest and most powerful critiques of then the sort of fashionable trends that had emerged within media studies towards the more cultural studies, would be the inaccurate term, I would say, the more, less structural approach to analyzing media and society. But also in that book, Culture Inc., was some really original work where he talked about the First Amendment, mm-hmm. and the notion of the First Amendment. It was very influential in how that First Amendment had changed and how it was being reinterpreted. Talk about that for a little bit, if you would.
Well, he was talking about certain of the decisions the Supreme Court had made in the latter part of the 70s, and how it shifted the definition of information to one in which it was basically a property of corporations. And also, in addition to that, that corporations could be considered individuals or persons of some sort rather than corporate entities. They were redefined as natural persons. And once that took place, the next building block to this change of the First Amendment or interpretation of the First Amendment was to say that what corporations said was speech, the speech of a person. And in that sense, you could say that advertisers have a right to say what they say and not be challenged because it's their First Amendment right. This was a transformation of the definition of the First Amendment, and you've written an excellent follow-up to this argument.
No, it's had a tremendous amount of influence in my work and many others, because what Schiller did, I think, first in any sort of coherent manner was argue that the formal expansion of the First Amendment to include all sorts of commercial activities, instead of being something we should be glad about, because you would normally think expanding the First Amendment means the domain of democracy is greater, there's that much protection from more increased protection from government surveillance. In fact, this expansion to all these commercial activities is really a shrinking of the domain of what the public was allowed to govern, mm-hmm, the domain exactly. of self-government. And it was really a striking argument, one that rings more true today than ever. And I think that what comes through in your book, Rick Maxwell, about Herb Schiller, is that many of the themes he was concerned with, the themes, the concerns, are as pertinent today as they were in 1960s, 70s, 80s.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've inherited a lot of the same concerns, but also the same history. We are in the same flow of history that Herb Schiller was in, and the conflicts and contradictions are the same. Some of the situations have become more extreme with current administration, and I try to outline that as well. He didn't have a chance to analyze this, but in his memoirs, you know, he really did foresee the possibility of this right-wing authoritarian government that we are experiencing today. And in an almost uncanny way, he lays out the possibility for what's happened to us.
And we're talking a lot about Herb Schiller's critique of the status quo in the United States and internationally, and you've said he's a person of the left, that he was a progressive. I mean, what was he fighting for? What drove him? What sort of world was he looking for? And I don't mean just abstractly, like world peace, but I mean, what were the tangible political changes he wanted to see in this country and globally?
Well, he wanted to see an end to to imperialism. Obviously, the choice of focusing on American empire was just a historical one. If he had lived in another era, he would have focused on Britain. But the fact is that the U.S. had become the lone hegemon, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union. And this was a concern of his throughout his life, to really lay bare the communication and cultural dimensions of U.S. imperialism. I think the great struggle for him was to be a part of anti-imperialist movement, in generally speaking, but to really be a voice raising loudly these issues around communication and culture, and to continue to make that push. It's not just about economics, he would say. It's not just about culture. You have to integrate your understanding of the political, the economic, and the cultural in order to understand the role of these institutions within the dominant political economy.
Did Herb Schiller ever belong to a political party, run for office? Was he ever linked with a particular group, or was he mostly operating as a writer and a scholar independently?
He was an independent writer and scholar, and you know he belonged to the AAUP. You know, I mean, just like us, he might have been a member of a union. I don't know, just like I am right now. So. Mm-hmm. The point is that, you know, it's never explicit in any of his work if he was a member of a party or if he had any political aspirations at all. He backed a progressive party in the post-war.
The Henry Wallace campaign.
Exactly. And, he liked what Wallace had to say, but that was sort of the last of it. I think he was disillusioned by American politics in that sense.
We're talking to Rick Maxwell today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Maxwell is the author of the new book, Herbert Schiller, about one of the seminal figures in U.S. and international media studies. This is a tape-recorded show. Please don't call in. We've only got a few minutes left to wrap up today our discussion. I want to get a few more points in. Now, you knew Herb Schiller. You obviously liked him. That's come through in the book and in our interview today. Did that make it difficult to write this book?
It was it was a great pleasure to write this book, but it was also very difficult because I wanted to do justice in some ways to my friend and mentor. And so, you know, I felt sometimes like I was, you know, walking on eggshells, you know, around certain issues. How do I deal with the criticism that I read? Well, you know, in some ways I'd heard it all my life, so I knew what to say. You know, for the most part, I wanted to present not just a picture of Herb Schiller, but I wanted to present an exemplary communications scholar on the left. I wanted to really to try to get across the spirit and the attitude of this man too. So I drew on my personal relationship with him in some ways to try to get that to the reader, so that they could see that it wasn't just about the dry analytics that that you might read into his books, but rather this is about the character of the man and his spirit too. Just so I could convey that in some way in the writing. That was difficult, but also some of the great pleasure of writing this book.
Does Herb Schiller have people out there now, or did he, or just really opposed him and wrote negatively about him? Did he have enemies? I mean, did you have to grapple with this?
All the time, and most of the time now, a lot of younger scholars who've learned from their professors who taught them badly that Herb Schiller was one thing or another thing and have never read his work. And even some friends of Schiller, I suppose, you know, I guess in terms of the communication studies, who really haven't done the kind of close reading that I've tried to do here, sort of misinterpret sometimes the things that he said, you know, about cultural studies, for example. He really never mounted a major critique against cultural studies. He had some problems with a certain area of cultural studies, as others did. He took on a number of different writers, but it was always not to win a position with academia, kind of, you know, contest of wits, but rather to really talk about the role of the intellectual in history and in the history in which we live. And that was, I think, what he was most inspired by.
What do you think, as you look back on Schiller's career, now you yourself, a chair of a media studies department at Queens College, have been in this field now for as a grad student and a professor for approaching 20 years.
Yes.
As you look at this, the world today, what influence has he had on media studies? How does the field of communication study in the United States different today than it was some many years ago as a result of Herbert Schiller?
Well, both Dallas Smythe and Herbert Schiller, I mentioned Dallas Smythe earlier as sort of the founder of political economy area. If it weren't for them, we wouldn't have courses in political economy. Well, we might, but we don't know. Their students teach political economy. The students of their students teach political economy.
In fact, I have to confess, I'm teaching the same class Herbert Schiller taught here. So
That's very cool.
Yeah, there you go.
And, I mean, this is one thing to think about, critical communication studies. There are many many people to draw on for understanding that area, but Herb Schiller represents almost the man who established a certain kind of discourse about writing about cultural imperialism, for example. Even the phrase cultural imperialism cannot be said without citing Herbert Schiller's writing.
Let me put it another way, if I can, Rick, because we've only got a minute or two left. When Herbert Schiller came on the scene in the 1960s, except for Dallas Smythe, it was a pretty lonely world to be critical of the United States, to call it an empire, to be critical of capitalism, to be seen in the political left, even in the 1960s in the United States, and in a field of communication, which was fairly mainstream in general. If you look at the field of media studies today, are things a lot better than they were in the dark days of the 1960s when Herbert Schiller was off in the wilderness?
Yes, absolutely. This, as I said, it's sort of the generations, I could be considered third or fourth, it depends who you ask, generation of critical communications research, you yourself. We've all been able to create greater space within the institution for critical communications research, for progressive analysis of this material. You know, it's completely different. He was alone, and he Dallas Smythe was there, but Dallas was also alone and marginalized to a great extent by his colleagues at Illinois, who were snitching on him for the FBI, for example, Schramm and others. Herb was alone, but by the late 70s, there were already a new generation coming up, and Herb's family, Herb's sons. You could just see a kind of flowering of the generations in critical communications.
Rick Maxwell, our guest today in Media Matters, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Our time is drawing to a close. Rick Maxwell is the author of the new book, Herbert Schiller, published by Roman and Littlefield. I urge you all to read it. My name is Bob McChesney. Thank you for joining us. I'll be back 1 week from today.
AM 580 will broadcast NPR's live coverage of the 9/11 Commission hearings on Tuesday and Wednesday. NPR senior national correspondent Linda Wertheimer will anchor coverage beginning at 8 a.m. each day, continuing through the afternoon. Tuesday's coverage will include testimony by Secretary of State Colin Powell, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and former Secretary of State William Cohen. That's Tuesday and Wednesday beginning at 8 a.m. here on WILL Urbana.
Mostly cloudy skies today, high in the upper 30s, north winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, low around 18 degrees, north winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Partly sunny tomorrow, high in the lower 40s, west winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, low in the mid-20s, southwest winds around 5 miles per hour, shifting to the south around 10 miles per hour after midnight. This is WILL Urbana.